From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. In the wake of the U.S. decision last week to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has invited Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas for talks in Cairo to explore ways to deal with the crisis. A statement said he'll seek ways to preserve the rights of the Palestinians to establish an independent state with East Jerusalem as its capital. Protests continued Sunday across the Arab and Muslim world, including this one in Pakistan's port city of Karachi. Meeting in Cairo Saturday, the Arab League called on the U.S. to abandon its position on Jerusalem. Jordanian Foreign Minister Ayman Safadi said the League rejected the U.S. position, saying it contradicts international legitimacy. The White House also expressed disappointment. A planned meeting between Palestinians and Vice President Mike Pence had been canceled. U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, appearing on Fox News Sunday, defended the decision on Jerusalem as the right thing to do.
We didn't set any parameters. We didn't say this was the final status. What we said is we're going to do like we do in every other country, and we're going to put the embassy in its capital, and we're going to continue and are going to continue that fact that we are as committed to the peace process as we've ever been before.
In Paris, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with French President Emmanuel Macron.
Et je partage totalement ce qu'a dit...
The French leader called on the Israeli leader to offer confidence-building measures toward the Palestinians, perhaps including a freeze of Jewish settlements. Kenya's opposition Sunday said it has delayed plans for an inaugural ceremony Tuesday of leader Raila Odinga, who lost an election rerun in October to incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta. The attorney general said last week a mock swearing-in could amount to charges of treason. This is VOA News. In Iraq Sunday, celebrations over the defeat of Islamic State. Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi looked on as troops marched in formation in Baghdad. It's a momentous development, says former Ambassador James Jeffrey, who just returned from the region.
First of all, Iraq has saved itself. The U.S. and the coalition provided a lot of help, to be honest. In the beginning, so did the Iranians, but it was Iraqi soldiers from the Peshmerga to the regular army to even these militias that took back their country from ISIS.
Iraqi forces recaptured the last area still under IS control along the Syrian border Saturday. It appears the socialists have swept local elections boycotted by the opposition in Venezuela, and President Nicolas Maduro announced his opponents will be barred from taking part in next year's presidential ballot. Raul Sanchez Uribarri, an analyst at Australia's La Trobe University, said this underscores what a terrible year for democracy it's been in that South American country.
Venezuela has become an authoritarian regime and dictatorship, and Maduro is clinging to power in different ways. Certainly, he wouldn't want to go to an election that would most likely lose if it were remotely free and fair, and if he was facing competitive candidates.
The socialists, widely blamed for the country's economic crisis, gained victories in October's governor races, and expects to increase the ruling party's share of some 70% of mayorships in Sunday's election. In Honduras, the country's electoral tribunal declared Sunday a partial recount of the disputed November 26 presidential election showed about the same outcome, giving a narrow victory to incumbent president Juan Orlando Hernandez. It's not clear how many votes were recounted. The vote counting suffered delays in releasing results. After declaring victory early in the vote count, opposition candidate Salvador Nasralla accused the tribunal and ruling party of fraud. In Sweden, police arrested three suspects in a failed arson attempt at a Jewish synagogue in the second-largest city, Gothenburg. The arrest came after a burning object was thrown at the building, which did not catch fire. Some 20 Jewish young people were at the scene and briefly took shelter. No injuries were reported. British Prime Minister Theresa May is expected to tell Parliament Monday there's a new sense of optimism in talks on leaving the European Union after striking an initial agreement last week. The two sides are to meet in a summit Thursday with the aim of finalizing the deal to end their relationship after more than 40 years. Snow caused travel disruptions across central England and northern Wales Sunday, grounding flights, shutting roads, and delaying train travel. As much as 28 centimeters of snow fell on the region, what's described as the heaviest snowfall in 4 years. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Pony Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, December 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Tuesday's swearing-in of Raila Odinga as Kenya's alternative president has been postponed.
It is a day that was being awaited eagerly by NASA supporters. So when the announcement came, they have received the news with great disappointment.
Ruth Wanjiku Njuguna is a journalist with Kenya's Radio Citizen. In Liberia, Charles Bramskin says his Liberty Party will decide soon which candidate to support in the coming runoff election. And Togo's government releases more political detainees as a gesture for dialogue with protesting opposition supporters.
The president calls for openness and for the opposition to show commitment so that we can find a compromise. Since then, we have been taking a number of measures that can help create an environment conducive to a fruitful dialogue.
Gilbert Bawara is Togo's Minister for Public Administration. The United Nations says more than 4,500 civilians were either killed or wounded in Somalia in less than 2 years. And world leaders discuss fighting air pollution in Africa. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenya's opposition National Super Alliance, known as NASA Coalition, has postponed Tuesday's scheduled swearing-in of leader Raila Odinga as the country's alternative president. The group said in a statement Sunday that it reached the decision after consultations and engagement with national and international mediators. President Uhuru Kenyatta was re-elected with 98% of the vote in a repeat election held on October 26, which Odinga boycotted. Ruth Wanjiku Njuguna, a journalist with Kenya's Radio Citizen, says the postponement was the result of many factors, including pressure from the international community, religious leaders, coupled with internal disagreement over the inauguration. But she said the postponement left millions of Odinga supporters disappointed.
The NASA principals that addressed the press said they have postponed to a later date. And this is to the disappointment of very, very many followers of NASA who are only expecting the time that Raila Odinga, their leader, would be sworn in. The other NASA principals that addressed the press said that after consultations here in the country and outside the country, they have decided to postpone the ceremony of swearing in Raila Odinga to a later date. What is interesting in this matter is that Raila Odinga's signature was not in the statement that was issued. And we have informers in NASA who are saying that perhaps there is fallout among the principals on the swearing in of Raila Odinga. And also remember that the person that is supposed to be sworn in as the deputy president, Kalonzo Musyoka, is not in the country at the moment. He's in Germany. And also the attorney general of the country, Yitumuigai, had also said that if anyone attempts to swear in Raila Odinga as the president, that would amount to high treason. It is a day that was being awaited eagerly by NASA supporters. So when the announcement came, they have received the news with great disappointment.
You said a great number of NASA supporters have been disappointed. What percentage of the population do you think was really expecting the inauguration of Odinga?
I go with the number of registered voters, those that can actually cast their vote. That was about 19 million. And NASA has almost half of the supporters. So half of the 19 million people that are registered as voters in the country are disappointed because they have all along been saying that they too do not recognize President Uhuru Kenyatta as the president. So we have really received the news with anger. Some of them have seen like online. They are saying they no longer feel part of NASA. They feel betrayed. But remember, there has been pressure too from even the international community on NASA and the government leaders to sit and agree.
So Ruth, you mentioned earlier about the internal debate within NASA itself. The fact that this inauguration is postponed, could it be that the moderate voices within NASA have prevailed so far?
Yes, you can say the moderate voices in NASA have prevailed because the information we are getting from NASA insiders is that their leader, Raila Odinga, had insisted that the swearing-in ceremony must proceed on Tuesday. But again, we have other principals in NASA, including Musalia Mudavadi and Moses Wetangula, who are part of the press conference. And we are being told that it is them that have gone against Raila Odinga. I think he was left by himself standing and insisting that the ceremony must proceed on Tuesday. But again, these others, I think they must be looking at different scenarios, looking at the impact of going ahead and serving in Raila Odinga as the president. And remember, a person like Musalia Mudavadi is a person that I would say he still has a future in politics. So I don't think he would like at this point in time to soil his name in going ahead and participating in serving in of Raila Odinga.
Ruth Wanjiku Njuguna is a journalist with Kenya's Radio Citizen. She was speaking with us from the capital, Nairobi. In Liberia, the man who challenged the country's October 10th presidential election results in the Supreme Court says his Liberty Party will decide soon which candidate to support in the coming runoff election. Senator George Weah of the Coalition for Democratic Change and incumbent Vice President Joseph Boakai of the ruling Unity Party will contest for the presidency when the Election Commission announces the runoff timetable. Charles Bromskin did not deny nor confirm rumors that his Liberty Party is leaning towards supporting George Weah. He said an announcement will be made once the Election Commission announces the timetable for the runoff.
I expect the party to make a decision in due course. I don't think a decision will be made until an official date is published for the runoff.
Let me ask you what I think is some rumors out there that your Liberty Party is about to declare its support for Senator George Weah.
Well, like I just said to you, the party has not made a decision. Our party is a very deliberate one. The deliberations will take place and a decision will be arrived at. And I promise you, I'll call you as soon as a decision is made.
The Supreme Court has handed down its ruling now. Personally, what's your view?
The Supreme Court ruled that, among other things, that although there were fraud, although there were irregularities, they were not sufficient to warrant a rerun. The Supreme Court, however, and unfortunately, went on to say that some of the issues we complain of need to be corrected before the runoff election. Having said that, the Supreme Court forgot that those were the same issues that affected us, adversely impacting us in the first round. We remind the court that our equal protection under the law was violated by the court. Because if the court determined that there was sufficient fraud, there were sufficient irregularities that needed to be corrected before the runoff, then certainly the court should have considered that those things affected us as well. But like I said, it's been brought to a conclusion. We accepted the judgment, and Liberia is moving on. And we're good for James because this is the first time in a long time that we've had elections and there have been disagreement as to the results of the election. And we didn't bring war. No one got killed. No one got injured. We're looking forward to the runoff.
In a way, Mr. Bromskin, do you feel kind of vindicated? Because I think in the eyes of some Liberians, you are kind of the election villain.
Well, from the feedback I get here is that there are many who appreciate the role that we played. And Jim, this was never about me. You know, I have lost twice and I have walked away. It was about our country. This was about the many Liberians who voted and their votes were not counted. It was about many Liberians whose votes were diluted.
What happens now, Councillor Bromskin? As you said, you have run for election maybe this third time now. What happens now politically for you?
Well, it's still too early. Like I indicated to you, I'm taking a trip out of the country for a week to attend to some business. When we come back, we will consult with those who are close to us, the party officials and family members, and we'll make a decision as to the role we play in the future. But I guess that our voice, our opinion will still be needed in moving our country forward.
Councillor Bromskin, thank you very much. Always nice to talk with you.
You're welcome, James. Thanks for calling.
Charles Bramskins, leader of Liberia's opposition Liberty Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, December 11th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Togo's government says Sunday it freed two imams who had been critical of President Faure Gnassingbé's administration as a gesture for dialogue with protesting opposition supporters. A coalition of 14 political parties has been demonstrating to demand a return to the country's 1992 constitution, which calls for a 2 5-year term limit for presidents. They also want President Faure Gnassingbé to step down. The African Union and the Economic Community of West African States have been trying to encourage dialogue between the government and the opposition. Gilbert Bawara, Togo's Minister for Public Administration, says the release of political detainees is a part of the government's efforts to create an environment conducive for a fruitful dialogue.
The president called for openness and for the opposition to show commitment so that we can find a compromise. Since then, we have been taking a number of measures that can help create an environment conducive to a fruitful dialogue. It is in that context that many people, I think now it is more than 60 people, have been released, including the two imams.
Are you saying that other people connected with the ongoing protests were also freed?
Yes, definitely. On the 6th of November, we released 42 people. A few days later, we released the Secretary General of the PNP. And then 3 days ago, we also announced the release of 22 people. If you added the two imams, it is 24 people. So we have always been open, and we believe the responsibility of the government to show openness and to make sure that all the conditions are created to facilitate the dialogue and overcome the current political arrest.
The opposition protesters have made the release of some of these people, like the imams and other protesters, a precondition. What do you want to say? Because we hear that more protests are being planned.
I think if the objective is really the release of a number of people before we can go to the dialogue, at this stage, the government has demonstrated its commitment and its openness. Now, if they have other agenda, we will continue to show openness, and I hope the opposition will also show some openness so that we can start the dialogue.
Of course, you know, one of the demands the protesters are making is that your president, President Faure Gnassingbé, should step down.
President Faure was democratically elected, and some of those who are demonstrating were also candidates. If they had been elected, would they also resign because of some Togolese asking for it? A president of the republic can only be elected by the population through democratic elections. Outside this framework, I don't see what is the legitimacy of a number of people. Because when people say they are representing the Togolese population, how do they know that?
So, yes, you said that President Faure Gnassingbé was elected. Those who are protesting, they say that his elected term is over, that he cannot serve another term.
Masona, you know, I cannot answer in those type of issues. We are in a democracy. People are free to have their opinion, including by saying the president was not well elected or he should resign. This is their liberty. I don't want to comment it because it will not help the country to advance.
Gilbert Bawara is Togo's Minister for Public Administration. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lomé. The United Nations says more than 4,500 civilians were either killed or wounded in the Somalia conflict in less than 2 years. The UN says from January 1, 2016 to October 14, 2017, it documented 2,078 civilian deaths and 2,507 injuries. The world body said the worst perpetrators of the killings are Al-Shabaab, which is responsible for more than 60% of the casualties, according to the report, clan militias and state actors, including the army and the police. Letitia Bader of the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch says the report is very important given the difficulties in getting data about human rights violations in Somalia due to insecurity.
It clearly shows that when it comes to civilian killings, casualties, abductions of civilians, but also recruitment of children, Al-Shabaab is by far the worst perpetrator. But it also underlines very clearly how civilians are completely affected, sometimes targeted by ongoing clan conflict in many parts of the country, also because of indiscriminate fighting between security forces, and as well as a result of mistreatment during detention by government forces.
And given this figure by the United Nations, do you think this number is conservative or accurate?
It is very difficult to say, and I think the report itself is very honest in terms of highlighting just how difficult it is to systematically collect data on civilian casualties in Somalia. And I think in many ways this is why this has not been happening until now. If you compare to other countries with ongoing conflict, all this sort of data has been collected. And I think in Somalia you do have some civil society groups which try to document incidents within their own town, but a kind of broad picture like this has not been made available before. Now, from my own research and the research we have conducted, a lot of the grave abuses which are documented in this report and quantified to a certain extent in this report are ones which we ourselves have continue to document, whether it is cases of sexual violence against internally displaced people, whether it is ongoing recruitment of children by Al-Shabaab. So a lot of the things that they document in this report are ones which confirm and corroborate our own research. But I would say the baseline they offer is very unique and in that sense very important.
Who is supposed to be protecting these civilians? Who is not doing their job?
Well, obviously, the state has the fundamental responsibility towards offering protection to civilians on their territory. Now, in a context of conflict, those responsible for ensuring that civilians are not harmed indiscriminately, disproportionately, are all actors to the conflict. Local groups, clan, militia, all those have responsibility when they are conducting fighting to protect civilians. But at the same time, these are responsibilities which the African Union forces have, which other regional forces on the ground have, and which also international forces conducting operations on the ground also have to abide by the laws of war, which are very clear in terms of protecting and minimizing harm against civilians.
That's Letitia Bader of the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch speaking with reporter Haroon Maruf of VOA Somali Service. The United Nations Environment Assembly just concluded its global session in Nairobi, Kenya, where leaders made commitments to environmental protection. Air pollution was identified as a significant threat to public health in Africa. Jackie McGlade is the United Nations Environment Program Chief Scientist and Pollution Expert. She spoke to Ricky Stryak from the Assembly in Nairobi about some of the worst affected cities in Africa and the proposed solutions.
We have pollution in cities caused by fuel, what I would call burning of rubbish on the sides of the roads, and actually generated within an urban setting. And then we have cities that have poor air pollution because of sand and dust storms. Some of the top cities that really suffer in their central areas, including places such as Nairobi, Accra, Cairo. So there's a broad band across all of Africa. In other words, it's not concentrated in any one area. On the sand and dust storms, however, then you begin to see that places such as Addis Ababa and certainly those within the eastern part of Africa really do suffer more and more from these phenomena of the winds picking up sand from the natural dust bowl in the Sahara, which is the largest resource, the largest sink and source of sand that we have in the world.
I think it's interesting, you didn't mention Lagos. I don't know, is that because it's not highly polluted?
Lagos certainly has pockets of high pollution at a very similar level to Accra. But again, I think that what we're seeing is that the local responses to some of these pollution control measures are already beginning to take effect.
Can you give me a few examples of some of those responses that are proving effective?
Fuel mixing is a classic one where if you take diesel and then you add vegetable oils and others, you get a really, really significant increase in the amount of particulates that...
Jackie McGlaze, the United Nations Environment Program Chief Scientist and Pollution Expert. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Nairobi, Kenya. Minutes past the hour, time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin with the news that 12 top clubs representing 8 African countries are set to do battle in the Tunisian city of Rades for the right to be crowned winners of the annual FIBA African Champions Cup, which will run from today up until Wednesday, December the 20th. The ACC is FIBA's Africa's Club Prime Basketball Competition. It is an annual event gathering the champions and top clubs from across Africa. From basketball to athletics, where Kenya's Dickson Kipsangtue and Rama Tusa of Ethiopia claimed victories at the Guangzhou Marathon and IWAF Silver Label Road Race in the southern Chinese city on Sunday. In the female category, the 24-year-old Rama Tusa continued her flying form this season. She built up a comfortable lead after midway and trimmed more than 2 minutes from her personal best to wrap up the third marathon title of her career in 2 hours, 25 minutes, 12 seconds. The men's race was won by Kipsangtue, who rallied up to upset Ethiopia's pre-race favorite Marcus Ginetti in the final 200 meters. His winning mark of 2 hours, 10 minutes, 3 seconds was just 2 seconds shy of the 2 hours, 10 minutes, 1 second course record set 2 years ago by Morocco's Abdullah Takharafet. And in rugby news, South Africa's national sevens team, the Blitzboks, crashed out of the Cape Town sevens on Sunday after New Zealand clinched the cup semi-final 19-12 at the Cape Town Stadium. The Kiwis used their possession in a much better manner and were ruthless on attack compared to the South Africans, who battled to hold on to the ball. In football news, Uganda cruised into the semi-final of the CECAFA tournament despite a 1-1 draw against Ethiopia on Sunday. It was Derek Nisambi who saved 9-man Uganda from crashing out of the tournament with a late equalizer against the hard-fighting Ethiopian side. Uganda will now wait for the Group A's last group matches to know who they will play in the semis next week. In the meantime, Zanzibar continued with their roller coaster run in the CECAFA Senior Challenge Cup 2017, booking a semi-final slot after holding host Kenya to a barren draw. The Islanders moved to 7 points after 3 matches, and a win against Libya later today will see them top Group A. And finally, Nigeria's Super Eagles are set to face Poland in a pre-World Cup friendly. Technical advisor Gernot Rau told the French publication Football 365 that the match is scheduled for March 23 and will serve as a tune-up match for Nigeria's World Cup opener against Croatia. The German tactician believes facing Poland is an ideal preparation for the Croats because of their similar playing styles. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Kenya's opposition National Super Alliance, known as NASA Coalition, has postponed Tuesday's scheduled swearing-in of leader Raila Odinga as the country's alternative president. The group said in a statement Sunday that it reached the decision after consultations and engagement with national and international mediators. That is it for this Monday, December 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley. I'm James Butter in Washington, hoping you have a productive week.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. Believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.